in which we parse Chairman Powell's words, we play around with streaming content, and we put this question to American consumers. Christmas trees, real or fake? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 30th of November, if you can believe that. Good as always to have you along, everybody, here with a thesis for the next 5 minutes and 30 seconds of this radio program, that even as the political news is heating up, a change of control in Congress, the Mueller investigation, of course, as well, so too is the economic news. The Fed, trade and tariffs, the G20, maybe some signs that things are slowing down. I don't know. Gina Smilek is at Bloomberg. David Gura is at MSNBC. They are both in our studios in New York. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, David, test the thesis for me, man. What do you think? What?
So, there was this amazing moment today when you had Justin Trudeau there with outgoing president of Mexico and President Trump at the G20 on the sidelines of that, signing this U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, which the Canadians still call the new, new NAFTA. And this was like a delicious part of the write-up of that in the Washington Post. The president signed it with one of those trademark Donald Trump Sharpies.
Yeah.
And the other officials there used just regular pens to do it. And the president talked about all the acrimony that had gone into that deal, but it had dissipated. And you saw all these world leaders just like putting on a face, as they often do at these world meetings. And you're right, there's a whole lot happening here at home, but you still see a president who's uneasy when he has to leave the country and do one of these multilateral meetings. And the trade deal has been inked. We'll see what happens next. He goes back to Washington, where Democrats are going to be in control. They've got gripes about what this means for environmental standards, what this means for labor standards. So he sees it as a done deal. We'll see what happens next.
Gina, let's go to the G20, actually, since David took us there. Let's stay there for a minute. Big meeting coming up with President Xi. Who knows what's going to happen? My personal guess, and I'm going to crib this from Evan Javers at CNBC, he said today on his Twitter feed, that what he's hearing is there's going to be a squishy positive. That is no real progress, but the president's going to be able to come out of this with something where he can say, look, I got a better deal, and then everybody's going to go, yay, you know?
You know, I feel like there's some precedent for that. So similar meetings with Jean-Claude Juncker really did help to fend off worst auto tariffs for the EU.
Right. This is the one at the White House a number of months ago, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so we've kind of heard this song before a little bit. But as my colleague Sean Donnan wrote earlier today, you know, I think we're sitting in sort of this sort of situation where the best case scenario might be that things don't get worse. And so we already have these $250 billion in tariffs, but $200 billion of those are 10%, and they're slated to go up to 25%. And so that could be one of those things that's on the table. And beyond that, the president has signaled a willingness to roll out additional tariffs on consumer goods from, you know, things that could affect laptops, iPods, et cetera. And so if you see some sort of deceleration in tensions where those things are no longer on the table, I think we could sell that, or that could be sold as a win.
As the squishy positive. So, David, it's great, right? Speaking of things not getting worse, Chairman Powell of the Fed gave a big speech this week in New York in which he said a couple of things. One was, we're going to see what the data has to say. But the other one was, in essence, everything's fine and maybe sort of kind of we're going to pause on interest rate increases. That's certainly what the markets heard, right?
Yeah, and Gina was at that speech, so I'll defer to her on sort of how that went down in the room. But there was this piece in the Wall Street Journal this week that were like, the rules that Jerome Powell has dealing with the president. And number one was speak not of Mr. Trump. And another one of those rules was talk about the economy, not politics. I mean, the criticism that he's taken has been withering. The president did a number of interviews this week, and the Fed was a frequent target in those interviews. You know, he said, let's see what happens with Jay Powell. He says he's not even a little bit happy with Jay Powell. This is unprecedented. We haven't seen these kind of attacks before, kind of questioning of the Fed chair that we're seeing from President Trump. And it struck me as somebody who wasn't in the meeting or the speech that Jay Powell gave here in New York that, you know, he's done yeoman's work of ignoring that as much as he can, going about his work. And I just have to remind people, this is the guy that the president picked to do this job.
Right.
He picked him for this 4-year term. And now, again, in this unprecedented way, he's levying so much criticism at him.
So, Gina, take us back into that room. Did Powell say what the markets heard, that basically I got your back and don't worry about it?
So I think this is such an interesting question, and I feel like next week is actually going to clarify it for us. So what Powell said was basically an exact walk back of something he said in October that made markets really pile on this idea that the Fed might be getting more aggressive. So he walked that statement back really hard, and it was a little bit technical, so I won't get into the jargon. But markets, I think, took this and sort of applied this principle of every market overreaction must have an equal and opposite overreaction, and really ran with it, and are just really taking, you know, Fed hikes for next year off the table as a result of this. And so I think what's going to be really interesting in the ensuing weeks is to watch what Powell's colleagues and what Powell himself are saying. And I think from their coming statements, we'll get a sense of whether this market reaction was something Powell anticipated and tried to get, or whether this was an overreaction too. And I don't think we actually have the definitive answer to that yet.
David, take 15 seconds and give me an economic gut check. Get away from the headlines and the tariffs and the trade and Powell and all that, and tell me how you think it's feeling out there.
I thought you were going to do one of those five words or less.
No. I got to shake it up with you, man. You've been doing this too long.
Five words or fewer. Excuse me for the grammar police. I think that we're at a point of the year where the health of the consumer economy seems pretty good. This is shopping season, of course, going into the holidays, so there's that. But I think that there's room for concern about housing. There's room for concern about trade still. We'll see what happens at this dinner tomorrow night. But there is, you know, as you read commentary about the economy, some sense that what's been happening globally has to encroach just a little bit on what's happening here in the U.S.
That, of course, is the Trump Xi dinner tomorrow night. So, Gina, 15 seconds. How are things feeling out there? What's your gut?
Yeah, consumers are feeling good, but the housing market is slowing down. And I think the Fed is going to have to watch that as we head into 2019, because it could really weigh on the outlook.
There you go. 15 seconds. A pro. Gina Smiley at Bloomberg. David Gurr. I know, right? David Gurr is at MSNBC. You can catch him on the weekends early in the morning up on NBC with David Gurr. Or MSNBC with David Gurr. See you guys. Take it easy.
Thank you, Kai.
All right.
Thank you. Be good. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today. Look, you heard about that Marriott hack this morning, right? 500 million people affected. Shares down just over 5.5% today. Here is the bigger picture, though. These hacks are becoming so common that Wall Street analysts have figured out a way to model what they are going to do to a company's share price. Morgan Stanley says day of losses on the day of an announcement of a hack. Losses are about 4% on a company's share price, 6% after a week on average. So we'll see how that plays out with ticker symbol MAR Marriott. In some non-hacking equities news, an upend to the week. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so picking up where David Gurr left off on this NAFTA signing thing, even for a person given to hyperbole, President Trump's statements about the new NAFTA deal he signed with the leaders of Canada and Mexico this morning were pretty... well, they were grand. One of the most important and largest trade agreements in U.S. and world history, he called it. So with the caveat that the U.S. Congress and the Canadian and Mexican legislatures do still have to sign off on the thing, and notwithstanding all the sound and fury about it, what's going to change? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on that one.
There's nothing earth-shakingly different about the new NAFTA.
The agreement is much like the old agreement.
Jeff Schott is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. There are a lot of small changes that some U.S. industries will welcome. For example, Canada and the U.S. had been fighting over where tech companies could store data from Canadian citizens.
Canada will no longer be able to say to tech companies, you have to keep your data of Canadian consumers in Canada.
Mark Warner is a Canadian trade lawyer. Pharmaceutical companies in Canada and Mexico will have to wait a little longer, 10 years up from 8, to start making generic versions of U.S. drugs. The most notable change covers automobiles. Under the new NAFTA, more auto parts have to be sourced in North America, and 40 to 45% of vehicles have to be assembled by workers earning $16 an hour or more.
And that's clearly a rule that's carved at Mexico, and either driving up the wages there or keeping more production from actually shifting south of the border.
Jonathan Smoke is chief economist at Cox Automotive. He says that'll keep jobs in the U.S.
It's a preserving of the status quo fundamentally.
What it might also do is raise prices for people buying cars in North America. This is all, of course, if the new NAFTA gets ratified by the legislatures in Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. Dan Eikenson is with the Cato Institute.
Its prospects going forward are very unclear. The politics of trade continues to be very divisive.
Divisive and unpredictable. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
We've been doing a bunch of housing stories this week amid some early and yet perceptible, as Gina alluded to, signs of a slowdown in real estate. Here's another one, another story that is, with a twist. You know how sometimes you'll be on a highway and all of a sudden a house will drive by, or like half a house followed by the other half. You don't see those double wides as much as you used to, but with affordable housing ever harder to come by, manufactured homes are losing their stigma as unattractive, flimsy, and tornado-prone. They're making a bit of a comeback, too. Today, none other than the government-backed mortgage finance company Freddie Mac offered its seal of approval with a new pilot program to increase lending for factory-built homes. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
They have names like The Exhilaration and The Chateau. And David Itram, head of marketing for Texas-based Titan Factory Direct, says,
if I were to blindfold you and take you one of our models, you would never know you're in a manufactured home.
Because you'd be too busy being dazzled by the amenities.
9-foot flat ceilings, stainless steel appliances, farmhouse sinks.
The outside will still look more manufactured than a traditional home made of brick or stone. These houses have to be light enough to ship. But instead of $350,000, Itram says a top-of-the-line 2,000-square-foot home would cost around $150,000. Affordable housing advocates believe that difference could help solve the affordability crisis.
There's a tremendous opportunity. Manufactured housing in and of itself, we've estimated, is about 35 to 47% cheaper per square foot than existing site-built housing.
That's Elena McCargo with the Urban Institute's Housing Finance Policy Center. She says one barrier to demand has been financing. Factory-built homes are often paid for with so-called chattel loans, which tend to have higher interest rates. Freddie Mac's pilot program will provide conventional mortgage financing with low down payments. Mike Dawson oversees affordable lending strategy for Freddie Mac.
It's going to take time, but I think it's going to make a material difference in this market over time.
Dawson wouldn't say how much the company expects to invest during the two-year pilot. You know who else is investing? Warren Buffett. Berkshire Hathaway owns the largest builder of manufactured homes and two of the top lenders. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Don't look now, but there is about to be another video streaming service competing for your eyeballs. Warner Media, newly under the ownership of AT&T. It owns HBO and a bunch of iconic TV content, including Friends and The West Wing. Warner Media says it's got a subscription service coming next year. The thing is, as I alluded to, there's already a whole lot of streaming going on, right? Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, new ones coming from Disney and Apple as well. That's a whole lot of shows and a whole lot of passwords to remember. So, when do consumers just say, I can't do it anymore? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports.
There are dozens of shows Michael Tidd and his wife want to watch.
Let's see, Better Call Saul, Ozark, The Wire, Law and Order, binging those old episodes on Netflix. There are a lot of music documentaries.
Tidd, who lives in North Carolina, is reading from a Google spreadsheet with a list of 60 shows he and his wife follow on Netflix and Amazon Prime. They have subscriptions to both.
You know, I can't justify adding another $10 or even $5 a month service right now when there's so much in the backlog.
There are so many ways to consume TV and movies online these days. Elisa Perrin is a media professor at the University of Texas at Austin. And she says, yeah, people have a breaking point.
I think about this a lot. And the sense I get, and from what I've seen, is maybe 3 or 4 services are viable at the high end.
Legacy media companies are thinking about this, too, as they launch their own streaming services. For a long time, they've licensed their original shows to Netflix or Hulu.
But we've already been seeing that as the rights agreements expire, increasingly the companies reclaim that control over that content.
Warner Media could move Friends and The West Wing to its new service. Consumers we talked to today said they weren't willing to sign up for a service for just one show. Nancy Yu is a health policy analyst in New York. There's an ESPN show she likes, but she says it's not worth another subscription.
Because I know it's on sort of auto repeat, and that once the show's over, that I'll forget to cancel it.
If it turns out you can't watch your favorite show anymore, you could always do what some other people fessed up to today and borrow a friend's password. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up,
It's not like people are going to, you know, wild forests for the most part and cutting down trees for Christmas.
Remember, the question is, real or fake? Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 1.99 today, 0.7%, closed at 25,538. The NASDAQ up 57 points, about 0.7%, 73.30. The S&P 500, 22 points to the good, 0.8%, 27.60 there. For the week that was, the Dow up 5.1%, the NASDAQ up 5.6%, the S&P 500 up 4.8%. General Motors shares, well, they picked up 3.2%. Today, CEO Mary Barra is going to go to Capitol Hill next week to talk about that plan to shut down production of 5 plants and cut up to 15,000 jobs. Industrial conglomerate Honeywell says it's going to move its headquarters from New Jersey to Charlotte, North Carolina, add 750 jobs there over the next couple of years. Honeywell up 0.6% today. You're listening to Marketplace. As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace has a mission that drives what we do every day, to increase economic intelligence across the country. But we can't do it alone. So please, become a Marketplace investor today in whatever amount you choose, and your donation will go twice as far thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. So please, donate today at marketplace.org.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. It's Molly Wood here, and I would love it if you would listen to a podcast I do with Kai Ryssdal. It's called Make Me Smart. Every week we get smart on all kinds of things, tech, economics, and culture. On this week's show, we get into the ups and downs of the housing market. Lots of housing markets are super hot right now, but we might be headed for a cool off. And for a lot of us, that's good news.
The new crisis for a lot of people is an affordability crisis, which is, it affects people's individual financial health, even if it's not a huge factor in the overall economy.
Make Me Smart. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We're all getting older. That's just the way it goes. But when you're thinking about an economy, sometimes that means things don't go so well, a problem that's especially acute in the state of Maine. It's got the oldest population, also the oldest workforce in the country. Median age is just above 44. And because time only moves in one direction, right, it's just going to keep on getting older. So the state is trying to get more young people to move in, and they're using a new hook. Come on over, they say, and we'll help pay off some of your student loans. Maine Public Radio's Robbie Feinberg has more on that.
So I don't know what I'm doing for...
So you are matching these up.
The sun is already setting on a recent Thursday evening at Sanford High School in southern Maine as teacher Catherine Pepe works with a student on a lengthy packet of algebra problems. Yet for Pepe, the workday isn't even close to over. At 5, she'll leave the school to teach a local adult education class until 9. On Mondays and Wednesdays, she drives an hour north to teach at a community college. The 14-hour shifts leave her exhausted.
I used to love running, but I've had to give it up. And honestly, I haven't run in 2 months, which is horrifying because it's my stress relief, but I don't have time to do it.
The extra jobs are necessary, Pepe says, to help pay off the mountain of student loan debt she accrued at the University of Southern Maine. She graduated in 2014 with a math undergrad and 2 master's degrees in special education and literacy. And like most students, Pepe took out loans that now total more than $100,000.
Usually I try not to think about it, but when I do think about it, it's kind of like a hole that you can never dig your way out of.
For Pepe and other graduates in Maine, that mountain of debt is less daunting, thanks to a decade-old policy called the Opportunity Maine Tax Credit. It works like this. If you recently graduated from college and choose to live and work in the state, you can take a tax credit of more than $4,000 of your annual student loan payments. For years, the program was for graduates of in-state schools, but 2 years ago, it was expanded to any recent college grad who lives and works in the state. Former Democratic State Senator Justin Alfond helped create the program.
We needed to create an incentive for Mainers and those who came into our schools to stay here and live, work, and play.
That's particularly important in Maine, the state with the oldest median age in the country, and it's getting older. The trend is part of why the Maine Department of Labor recently projected the state will add fewer than 100 new jobs over the next 8 years. In the face of that anemic forecast, business groups are now looking towards the Opportunity Maine tax credit as part of the solution to help convince young workers to move here full-time over the next decade. Yellowlight Breen is the president of the Maine Development Foundation.
Wage scales tend to be lower here than in Boston or New York or LA. So how do we compete?
Last year, about 9,000 people used the tax credit, only a fraction of those eligible. Maine lawmakers, including Democratic State Senator Justin Chenette, recently pushed to more than double the program's marketing and create a new full-time state employee to focus on getting more graduates aware of the tax credit.
We want young people from all across the country to move here, to live here, to start families here, and to have a new life here. And I think that is the message that we have to get out a little bit more loudly.
Damon Jones, a professor of public policy at the University of Chicago, is currently studying a federal student loan forgiveness program for teachers. He says it's unclear if loan forgiveness, much less tax credits, can lead people to move. Jones has found these programs to be confusing for graduates to wade through, even just to determine if they're eligible.
That is definitely a challenge that needs to be overcome if this program has any chance of succeeding.
Business leaders in Maine are banking on that success. They have a new initiative called Live and Work in Maine. Their website points prominently to the student loan tax credit as evidence the state, quote, puts its money where its mouth is. In Sanford, Maine, I'm Robbie Feinberg for Marketplace.
We're 7 days on from Black Friday today, which means, semi-officially, I guess, that we are 7 days into the Christmas season. So, if you celebrate, you're probably starting to thinking about getting a tree, right? Along with 95 million other American households. That is according to the American Christmas Tree Association, by the way. But do you go fresh or fake? Real tree or artificial? And which one is better for the environment? Karen Drake writes for the Express Desk at the New York Times, where she's done some digging on Christmas trees and the sustainability thereof. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So we're just going to bang these out, the artificial tree versus real tree myths here. Myth number one in this piece, cutting down trees is not always bad for the environment. Help me out with that one.
A lot of people thought that it was unfortunate to lose a tree to enjoy it for a few weeks of the year, maybe a month. But actually, the farmers, they grow the trees like crops. And when they cut a tree down, they generally plant at least one more in its place. So it's not like people are going to, you know, wild forests for the most part and cutting down trees for Christmas.
When you go out and or went out, I suppose, and talk to these local Christmas tree farmers, what do they have to say? I mean, are they, how's business for them? Or do they have supply? You know, all that stuff.
Yes. The farmers definitely want people to know they do have trees available. There were a lot of headlines last year about how prices were up and that there was a shortage of trees. It's just that farmers had planted less during the 2008 recession. And so since trees take about 10 years to grow, supply was tight and there was still a lot of demand.
Right. Let me take this off to a tangent a little bit. Give me the cost of real versus cost of artificial thing as of this year. Do you know it?
So the average prices for last year were $75 for a real tree and $107 for an artificial tree. Hmm. But you can use an artificial tree for many years, so it ends up being cheaper.
Right. Well, which gets us to point number two, that reusing that artificial tree does kind of reduce the environmental footprint of you gathering around the Christmas tree on Christmas morning.
There was a big, long study for an association that represents manufacturers of artificial trees. That study found that using a fake tree for five or more years has a lower environmental impact than a real tree. But, you know, there are a lot of factors involved,
right,
like water and energy use, carbon footprint, things like that. And the real tree industry kind of comes back and says, well, listen, at the end of the day, a tree that was made of plastic in China and is going to go to a landfill just can't be better for the environment.
Right. Well, and that gets me to the last point, right? In the big picture, when we're buying all the stuff we're buying wrapped in the cardboard and using the paper and flying to visit relatives and all that, the choice you make for a tree is not huge impact-wise.
No, it's not. You know, if you're concerned about the environment, there are certain things that you can do, but the tree is just one small part of the holiday. And there's also the question of lights and decorations. Using LED lights could make a big difference, for example.
Right. Do you celebrate Christmas? Do you do, and which tree do you use if you use a tree?
I do celebrate Christmas, but I haven't had a tree for a while. I do plan on getting a real one this year.
There we go. Karen Drake, reporting for the New York Times, this time on Christmas trees. Karen, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks for speaking with me.
This final note on the way out today, distinction without a difference department. Microsoft shares closed the day up about 0.6% or so. Apple, meanwhile, lost about 0.5%. That was enough to let Microsoft close out the day with a market capitalization of $851.2 billion, give or take, edging out Apple as the most valuable company in this economy, which is nice and good and yeah. But the really interesting part for my money is that it was, what, a couple of months ago that Apple became the first $1 trillion company in this country, which means at today's close, it's lost like $150 billion in market cap in like 8 weeks. That's a lot. All right, that's it. That's all we got. We're done. Dow up 199 points today, 0.7%. The NASDAQ up 57 points, about 0.7% there. S&P 522 points to the upside, 0.8%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday, all right? This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.